From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Caudet. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this past week. And today, our panel includes Boise State Public Radio reporter Troy Oppy, who also hosts All Things Considered, Ian Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Nate Sunderland, managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com, and Gretchen Parsons, managing editor with Boise Dev. Happy Friday, everybody. Nice to have you on the show.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
So, Troy, I want to begin with some breaking news in regards to an Idaho inmate on death row. What do we know?
Yeah, Gerald Pizzuto Jr., scheduled for execution by the state last year. The state could not obtain the chemicals necessary for death by lethal injection. That 30-day death warrant expired, and the state did not pursue another one because of the question about being able to obtain, a continued question about being able to obtain chemicals. Today, the state attorney general, Raul Labrador, after the change of administration in that office, in January, issued a new death warrant for Pizzuto's execution, saying he's following state law, which requires, because, and this is listed in the death warrant, because there is an active death sentence with no current stays, Idaho law requires that a death warrant be issued. The statement suggests that the state still does not have execution chemicals in hand. We're working to learn more about this, and I'm sure more details will come out in the next several days, but that is what we know right now. The death warrant is open for the next 30 days, which would be March 23rd as a deadline.
Okay. And Troy, I want to talk about some other news that came out this morning. And this is in regards to the University of Idaho homicide, where four students were killed late last year. And some news about the house where this happened.
Yeah. University of Idaho President Scott Green released a statement today on memorializing these four victims, Zanna Kernodal, Ethan Chapin, Madison Mogan, and Kaylee Gonsalves, who were killed in November. Relevant news today is that the owner of the house where the murders happened has donated that residence to the University of Idaho. The university has accepted the donation, and they plan to demolish it and erect some type of a memorial in that space. They're not exactly sure what that will be. It's early on. There's no apparent timeline to this as well, but that is today's announcement. President Green, in his message, also noting that scholarships in memory of three of the victims so far have already been established. The university is working with the Gonsalves family to establish a fourth scholarship in her name as well that will be endowed and funded by the Vandals Supporting Vandals organization.
And Troy, one thing I found interesting with this news coming out this morning was, and I believe this was the president of U of I saying this, so correct me if I'm wrong, is that also if by demolishing the house, it will kind of keep away, for lack of a better word, kind of the vultures who have been around this, right? Who keep trying to, talk about this in a way that is not helpful to the families of the victims,
yeah,
to the case itself. So that was part of the reasoning too, correct?
Yeah, and the line from President Green is demolition also removes efforts to further sensationalize the crime scene. He's characterizing this as a healing step, which you would think it certainly is. The attention, the spotlight shown on Moscow and the University of Idaho has been intense over this. And at the risk of sounding a little bit crass, I would say this is probably the best resolution for all parties. You have a home that is unlikely to be rented as an owner. Yeah. So that person is able to make a donation. The university can turn it in to something positive, to a way to remember these victims. And it's probably the best possible scenario for the physical property where the crimes occurred.
Mm-hmm. Gretchen, we've talked about this on the program before, and this is the Albertsons-Kroger merger. There's been a lot of backlash on this. What is going on right now?
Well, so Don Day, he just put together this analysis about if the merger were to get approved, what that would look like for the Boise market. They're still in the stages of working that out. So it's unclear, I guess, when or if they will reach a deal. But with that analysis, Don Day, he put together data and he found that if the deal did go through together, 48% of all grocery sales in the Boise market would go to Albertsons and Kroger. And the Boise market, it's defined as Ada, Boise, Canyon, Gem, and Owyhee counties. And so to break that down a little further, in 2022, Albertsons in the Boise market, they had $734 million in grocery sales. That was the most out of any grocery store in the market. Kroger came in number two at $526 million. And so combined, that'd be, let's see, $1.26 billion for a total of 48% of all shares. And they would, if they did combine, they'd operate 31 stores altogether in the Boise market. And just to give you an idea of where other grocery stores in our area, where they rank in terms of grocery sales in 2022. So as I said, Albertsons, they came in number one, Fred Meyer, number two, and then Walmart was number three. They did 522 million sales. After that was Winco, 343 million, then Costco, 255 million. Then it kind of drops off after that. It goes Ridley's, the Boise Co-op, Grocery Outlet, Trader Joe's, and Dollar Tree. We have a good graphic that Don made on our website. If you go to boisedev.com, it's kind of easier to see how grocery sales rank with the little chart he made. But yeah, it would be pretty significant. 48% of all grocery dollars spent in the Boise market would be on those two stores.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see, Gretchen, because I think that's where some of the pushback on this comes from, right? Is would you potentially be creating a monopoly with this merger?
And that's what I think a lot of people are worried about, especially in markets where maybe Albertsons and Kroger are the only options. Then it would appear to be a monopoly. So I think that's something people are worried about, and I'm sure that's a factor when considering if this merger will go through.
Yeah, Nate. So some criminal charges have been filed against the former Jefferson County prosecutor. Can you get us up to date? Because I know some new details have come out about this, but also a lot of people who maybe aren't in Eastern Idaho may not be aware of what's going on.
Yeah, sure. Robin Dunn was the Jefferson County prosecutor for 34 years. He's also been a city attorney for a whole bunch of smaller cities in Eastern Idaho. So he's very well known. He's been doing municipal law for a very long time. And this week he was found in a vehicle parked at a restaurant with a woman who was extremely high on fentanyl that also happened to be one of his clients that he was defending in another drug case. Officers got to the scene. They questioned Dunn and they got a little suspicious. So they called a drug dog to the scene. And at that point, Dunn tried to throw the dog off. He opened his door in an attempt to get the dog to pass through the threshold of the vehicle, which, as I understand it, means that if the dog passes into the vehicle, the search can actually be legally invalidated. So he was trying to play a little light with the law. Thankfully, the officer was able to keep the drug dog under control. It didn't go into the car, but it did alert to drugs being in the vehicle. So the officers pulled out Dunn. They searched him and they found that he had fentanyl on his possession, Narcan, and Xanax that wasn't prescribed to him. So he was arrested, and I guess we'll see what happens in court, and like we'll probably also see what happens with his legal license.
Right. And if he's convicted, I mean, he's facing what? Upwards of a decade in prison. Okay.
Yep.
So we will just have to wait and see what happens at this point. So, Troy, you have been looking into COVID and wastewater. So I'm curious about what you've been able to find out in regards to this in particular, because it seems like a lot of the tracking has maybe either stopped or slowed down or interest has lagged, but it does give us some good information.
It does. And I think it's the latter. I think interest has waned quite a bit as we've, you know, as a society really efforted to put this all behind us, whether that's appropriate or not. The city of Boise has partnered with Boise State to be pulling samples from two different locations in the city's wastewater system 3 times a week. They've been doing this for going on 2 years now. And what they found with testing the wastewater is that, especially as it related, they found this out in hindsight with the first surge of COVID. They realized that the wastewater could be a pretty good predictor of what was about to happen because the waiting period when you got exposed to the virus, the initial COVID virus in 2020, was so long before people would start showing symptoms. They could use it as a bit of a canary in the coal mine, so to speak. As that exposure time has shortened a little bit, the data has not appeared to be as useful. It is still useful, make no mistake about that, but it is less dead on, I guess, in that way. But what officials with the city have cautioned me as I've been reporting on this through several different times over the last 18 months plus is that individual day's results are only a snapshot, and there you want to be paying closer attention to that 14-day rolling average. Dr. Pate pointed out on this program Wednesday this week that you know that's a really good indication. It's probably the best indicator that we do have as a tool for community understanding of what the COVID virus is doing in this community because of home testing now, and that's not getting reported to the state, so there's less available data there. But the 14-day rolling average is a look backwards in time. It's still a good indicator, but it's a look backwards. And Dr. Pate said, you know, if you want to use those individual days' results, if there are several days' worth that are above that 14-day trend, that's a picture of where things might be headed. Now, in the last, let's say, 4 months or so, there have been several short periods of time where the individual day's results have spiked, in some cases dramatically. One of those instances ended up being an incorrect data submission and was fixed. But those spikes have always come back down. And so that's an interesting trend as it relates to what's happened in the last 4 months. They have not followed the previous patterns of spikes hitting a certain threshold and then continuing up and we get into a full-blown surge. That has not happened really since this time last year. And so that's interesting. The city is still using this data and is committed to continuing to share this data with the public as a way that community members can make their own decisions, what's best for their loved ones and themselves in terms of taking precautions against COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that's the point of it, right, Troy?
Yes.
Is that is there are people who are immunocompromised. There are people who, you know, have, as you mentioned, have people in their family, loved ones who might be more impacted by this. So the information is important and vital, whether you choose to use it or not.
Right. And I mean, I've followed this in the course of reporting, certainly, but I look at it and make determinations for my own life. You know, if I'm going to wear a mask, if I go to the grocery store, or if I go into a state house hearing room, for example, you know, I might look at that wastewater data and just see where the trend is to make that determination.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Nate, Lori Daybell was back in court yesterday. So, tell us why, and what happened.
Well, Lori and Chad were actually both in court
Okay.
Yesterday, and it was actually a little more focused on Chad. The biggest discussion in the hearing was whether they're going to try to sever the cases. And this is something that Chad's attorney, John Pryor, has tried several times before. This is his third attempt to separate Chad and Lori's case. The last two times the judge denied it, said, no, we're keeping them together. But we're kind of getting down to the wire here. We're 5 weeks away from the trial. And Chad's attorney keeps insisting that he's just not ready to take it to trial. He says there's still like 12 terabytes of data, of digital data that he has to go through. And he's just not ready. Plus, there's some DNA evidence, some hair that's still at an out-of-state lab. So he's making a compelling argument. And as we get close to the trial, there's a chance that this could actually be severed. I mean, the judge is historically stuck to his guns, but if John Pryor really feels like he's not prepared and the judge forces him to go through with it, that could be grounds for appeal in the future. And the judge really doesn't want that. So I think there's actually a chance here that the cases could be severed.
And Nate, can we talk a little bit about one of the victims' grandparents, JJ? His grandparents traveled all the way from across the country to be at the hearing. What are their thoughts on the cases being being severed?
They don't think they're going to be severed, and they certainly don't want them to be severed. They want them to be together.
Mm-hmm.
And they want justice to be served, and they think that to do that, they need to have both Chad and Lori in the courtroom together.
Okay. And so as of right now, as you mentioned, 5 weeks until this trial is set to start in Ada County, and the judge will, do a written decision on what he decides, but even if he severs the cases, but even if he severs the cases, Nate, that doesn't necessarily mean that, now Chad, you and your attorney can have more time.
No, but if they do sever the cases, that would probably, he would probably allow John Pryor more time. It would be Lori that would go to trial immediately. And they would probably reschedule Chad's.
And Lori's attorneys are not asking any longer, correct, for there to be a delay on
They're not. Okay. She has not. She's not waived her right to a speedy trial. She is very confident she's going to win. In fact, her attorneys even said that during the hearing yesterday. They told the judge she's very confident that she is not going to be convicted. And so she wants to get on the stand. She wants to testify, and she wants to get her story out there.
Okay, so she wants to start this trial April 3rd. So we'll just have to wait and see then what happens in the case of Chad Daybell and whether and what the judge decides. But man, they are coming up to that deadline quick.
Yes, they are.
All right, thanks for the update on that, Nate. We'll of course be watching to see what happens there. So, Ian, there are two vacant Boise City Council seats, and a lot of people are vying for those positions, including a former city council member who vacated one of those seats. So explain to us what's going on and actually why we also have these two vacant seats.
Yeah, so there's certainly been a lot of activity on the council in recent weeks and months. So the first vacancy came up because longtime council member Elaine Clegg was chosen to become the next CEO of Valley Regional Transit, which is the region's local public transit agency. So she's expected to resign soon. And as a result, there'll need to be a new council member to hold her seat for the rest of the year. The second vacancy that you mentioned is from a much more unusual circumstance, which is that Lisa Sanchez, at the start of this year, inadvertently left her district when she moved to a new apartment. She's a renter, and the apartment she was living at, she had to move from, and the apartment that she selected to move to ended up being outside of the boundaries of her district. And so the city's attorney's office determined that under state code, that meant that she had given up her seat. So as a result, there are now two vacancies on the council, and the mayor has been accepting applications to fill those two seats over the past month. And just this week, she announced that over 50 people have applied to fill those two vacancies, including Lisa Sanchez herself. So she's looking to get her seat back, and she also then plans to run again in November. And some of the other applicants include other prominent people in the city, including Grant Burgoyne, the recently retired state senator, Colin Nash, a current representative in the legislature of parts of West Boise, Patricia Nielsen, a retired urban planner who also ran for the Ada County Commission last year, as well as several other former candidates for city council, including Crispin Gravett and Brittany Sigliano. So there are a lot of people applying for these two seats. And I should say that the two seats are as a result of sort of the transition that the city's been undergoing to geographic districts. The two representatives will be a little bit different. One will be a representative of District 3, so they have to live in that district, which is includes the North End and Northwest Boise, basically, whereas the other seat to replace Elaine Clegg is an at-large seat. So that can be someone who lives anywhere in city limits. So the mayor's looking at those applications now, and she plans to make final recommendations in March, and then it'll be up to the city council to approve those two appointments.
So I know, Ian, you may not have the answer to this, but what struck me was the fact that former city council member Lisa Sanchez decided to put her name in for the seat that she gave up, which is in District 3. But why not try for the at-large seat? Because then you don't have to live in a specific district, correct?
Yes, that's true. However, so in the time since Lisa Sanchez learned that she had moved out of her district accidentally, she's actually moved back into her district, according to some letters from her attorney. So she now lives in the bounds of District 3, and so could be eligible to fill that District 3 seat or the at-large seat.
Okay, gotcha on that. So, Troy, we know businesses have been struggling to find workers, and this isn't something that's unique just to the Treasure Valley in Idaho. We're seeing it all over the country. But what I'm curious about is what projections employment-wise has the Idaho State Department of Employment made?
Yeah, the short-term employment growth is expected to continue through next year. That prediction from the State Department of Labor came out, released on Monday this week. Growth has been just precipitous, obviously, with the population growth here and working age people moving into the state, especially last year through about mid-2021 through 2022. Growth really shot up. Almost 50,000 people. And since 2016, the growth in employment in the state has been entirely up and to the right, with a few periods of a lull early on in the pandemic, as an example for one. The state predicts that employment will continue to grow by 1.4% annually to nearly 880,000 people next year. And just to give you an idea of that growth. In 2016, we were just over 700,000. So pretty substantial growth in the last about 6 years.
And I mean, and that goes to the fact, Troy, with that growth, I mean, more need for employment.
Oh, absolutely. People moving here are starting businesses. You know, the the unemployment rate is generally low to begin with, and of course has been. It's the unemployment rate at 2.9% in the month of December, and January's rate expected should be out here in the next couple of days. An interesting thing about the predictions, though, from the Department of Labor, the growth is not expected to be universally at that 1.4%. There are several sectors that are expected to grow much more than that, and that includes the information sector, construction as well, which we all know we need more housing, and transportation and warehousing with the growth of people buying things online and e-commerce. All those sectors are projected to grow 2.4% or more by 2024. And healthcare is expected to continue to grow as well at 1.8%.
Okay. Gretchen, Garden City is expanding ADU size. So first, can you explain what ADU is? And then second, what does that mean in terms of housing?
Sure. So ADUs, accessory dwelling units, they're also called mother-in-law suites. Basically, it's another smaller property on someone else's property, and they've been, in addition to the main house, I should say, and they've become more popular in the Treasure Valley as the area faces a housing shortage. It's also another way for a homeowner to make additional income and rent. And so, yeah, as you said, Garden City, they're in the final stages of finalizing new laws that would govern ADUs in Garden City. And so what they've come up with, the ADUs, they have a maximum of being 800 square feet or half the size of the main house, whichever is greater. And that's a little bigger than what Boise allows for. The laws in Boise, they currently allow the maximum size for an ADU to be 700 feet. So these would be allowed to be slightly bigger at 800 square feet. Also, the rules would say you could only have one ADU on each property, and it would have to be behind the main house. It would have a minimum of 300 square feet, and they'd have to have space for a kitchen, a bathroom, and a shower, so it could be livable. Mm-hmm. And they're still in the final stages of approving these laws, and this comes before Garden City has, you know, they haven't really touched the whole laws around tiny homes. And a lot of people have been, you know, either for or against that in Garden City. But yeah, this comes before they're dealing with that.
Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit about that? Because, and these are these tiny homes on wheels, because they've been, the city officials in Garden City have been studying a proposal, right, to allow these types of homes in Garden City.
Yes. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure where they are with that.
Okay.
And how they've come along with the progress. But that is something they're considering as well, because that would be, you know, another option as people are trying to find houses and there's a shortage. Tiny homes could be a solution. But yeah, they need to come up first with regulations to govern them, which they have not done yet.
Mm. Right. And, and what this all comes down to, Gretchen, and this goes back to even Troy's point about, you know, the need for, I mean, as we see more people moving in or, you know, employment issues, we also have housing issues. And mm-hmm. and so at least it seems the city of Garden City is trying to figure out ways to add more affordable housing in at least with ADUs.
And that's exactly what the Garden City mayor said. He said that, you know, ADUs, they're certainly not like the end-all solution, but it is another option in diversifying like the housing options that are available in the city, which is, yeah, the point, I guess, of allowing these types of homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Nate, let's head back over to East Idaho. A really interesting story coming out of Idaho Falls. And this is about an Idaho Falls teenager. She is truly being hailed as a hero. She saved a man's life.
Yeah. We're very impressed by this teenager. She's a 17-year-old girl named Grace Ponser. And she was in a gym in a Planet Fitness earlier this month when a older man who was on a treadmill fell over and started having a cardiac arrest. Mm. And the cool thing about this story was the teenager, or Grace, she'd just finished a CPR class at her school. And she hadn't been expecting to have to use that training for a long time, but suddenly she was there and this guy had just fallen, and she just jumped into action. She went over to him, started doing chest compressions. She got a couple other people to help. And they got heartbeat going again. And then they took an AED, which luckily the gym had, and they shocked him, and they were able to revive him before paramedics actually got to him and took him to the hospital. We spoke to a couple doctors afterwards, and they said that without our quick thinking and intervention, the guy probably would have died. So it's pretty cool. And now she's getting honored by the Idaho Heart Foundation this weekend. Very, very cool story.
Well, what I'm so impressed with, Nate, is that she kept her cool, right? I mean, because even when you have that training, you never know how you're going to react unless you're in a situation like that. And I mean, she knew exactly what to do, and that training just, I mean, went into effect.
Yeah, she just kicked in. She's a very impressive team.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Ian, can you talk to us about the latest in this investigation into the Boise Police Department? This is around potential racism within the department. So this goes back to a former captain after he retires, and all of this information coming out about organizations that he is affiliated with that promote racism.
Yes. So after those revelations last fall, the mayor and city council decided to launch an investigation into the police department, basically to see whether racism and racist views had infected, is the word they used, the police department in general. I think there were concerns that because this police captain and veteran officer had been at the department for so many years, whether there are any sort of broader issues in the department. So they hired a high-profile Washington, D.C. law firm called Steptoe & Johnson with a lead investigator named Michael Bromwich, who's a experienced litigator on these types of issues. He formerly served as the Inspector General for the Department of Justice, and he's also investigated local police departments in other parts of the country. And so that firm's work started in December. There's a team of lawyers led by Bromwich working on it. And I spoke with Bromwich recently, and he told me that they've so far interviewed more than two dozen people, around 30 interviews, and they've made two trips out to Boise for their work. And they've spoken to leaders at the police department, as well as city officials and leaders at City Hall. But it sounds like they're still, from their end, they think there's still a fair amount of work to do. It sounds like there are a lot more people they want to interview, including former members of the police department, some of whom Bromwich told me have been hard to track down, I think either because they've moved away perhaps or otherwise lost touch with the department. So part of their work is trying to track down those people who used to work for Boise Police. And yeah, so that investigation's ongoing, and they've also put together a website where residents can go and look at sort of the parameters of their investigation, the team of investigators, and also where people can write in with any tips. It's the website is BoisePDinvestigation.com. And Bromwich told me that so far they haven't gotten very many tips, which he said was disappointing because I think they're hoping to get comments and feedback from the community, which they'll use as part of their as leads as part of their investigation to see as they look at the police department. So I think they're looking to hear from people who have had experiences with the department.
Okay. And also, what about the funds that they have been using? Where are they at with that?
Yeah. So the city has authorized $500,000 to embark on this investigation. And so far what I've seen is an invoice from the investigators for the month of December. And that was for about $150,000 of work the lawyers did, as well as expenses for travel. So just doing some quick math there. And I was told actually by Bromwich that they've likely sort of spent more hours working on the investigation in January and now in February. So that means that they're going to be running up against the limit of their funds sometime at the end of this month or perhaps early next month. And so that's going to be, in the coming weeks, I think, a question for the city council of if there are more funds necessary, if the firm hasn't finished their investigation, is the council willing to authorize more money? Holly Woodings, the council president, told me recently that if that discussion comes up, she anticipates that there'll be quite a bit of conversation about that amongst council members. So I think it's sort of an open question how much the city is willing to spend on this investigation.
And Ian, I want to stick with you for a little bit longer because you also recently reported about a former Boise police chief who might run for mayor.
Yes. So I think it's shaping up to be an interesting year politically in Boise. This November, we've got elections for mayor and city council. And Lauren McClain is finishing up her first term in office, and she's running again this year. And so now I think it's a question of who might decide to challenge her in that race. And what I learned recently after speaking with former Boise Police Chief Mike Masterson is that he is considering a run for mayor. He told me he's not made a firm commitment at the moment, and he's still looking into this. But he's a possible candidate, and he served as chief of police from 2005 to 2015 under former mayor Dave Beter. And I'll also say that in addition to speaking with him, earlier this month, there was a survey that went out to Boise Democrats, a selection of Boise Democrats, asking them, if the race were held tomorrow, would you vote for Lauren McClain or Mike Masterson or someone else? And the survey also asked people sort of questions about those two, about McClain and about Masterson and how they might be perceived. So I think I don't know yet who paid for that survey and sort of who's behind it, but I think it's fair to say that there are groups in the city who are interested in bringing a candidate forward to challenge the mayor. And it seems like Masterson is definitely a possibility.
Well, as you said, it will definitely be an interesting race to watch along, I think, with those city council races in the city of Boise coming up in the fall.
Absolutely.
So, Troy, some pretty big news this weekend in terms of sports. We don't talk about it that often on Idaho Matters.
I'm so glad we are.
I know. So I have to tell you, I mean, I've got basketball fans in my house. So let's first talk about Boise State University and their basketball team.
Yeah, it's a good time in general to be a fan of college basketball in this state. But Boise State picked up a good win Wednesday night with New Mexico here in Boise, a nearly full extra mile arena, which the team loves, the university loves, of course. It's good energy in there. And they're in second place in the Mountain West right now. They've got a game coming up with San Jose State that is at home on Saturday, but the one with that game is in California Saturday afternoon. But the game upcoming that has all the eyes on it is here in Boise next Tuesday with division-leading San Diego State. That's basically a win and get a better shot at the conference championship with just a single game remaining after that, Utah State in Logan on March 4th.
So, Troy, with that said, where does that – if Boise State wins these next three games – where would that potentially put them in regards in potentially being part of March Madness?
Well, the general thought is by pundits who rank this stuff is that the Mountain West is probably a four-bid league. Some of that can change based on what happens in the conference tournament. And the regular season top eight, I believe, will go to the conference tournament That may have changed now that I say it out loud. But suffice to say,
I don't know.
The Mountain West tournament is very well regarded nationally. It's a pretty evenly matched. There's a lot of parity in this conference, and probably four teams are going to get in. So Boise State has a good shot. They need to keep winning, and certainly a top seed, or at least a chance at a top seed with a victory over San Diego State on Tuesday, would go a long way. Should be noted, though, Broncos on the road in San Diego earlier this season lost by 20 points.
Okay, and then if you're looking for some basketball this weekend here in the Treasure Valley, NAIA, what that's going on at... That's being hosted at the College of Idaho, right?
Yeah, so that is the Cascade Collegiate Conference, a group of schools from the Northwest. College of Idaho is the number one ranked team nationally at the NAIA level. They have the top seed in the conference tournament and then the right to host. They thought they would be tipping this off today, but Corbin, which is a college in Salem, could not get to Boise in time because their tour bus couldn't get out of the Portland area because of all the snow.
Yeah.
So that game got delayed to Saturday. They're still planning to play the rest of the conference tournament as close to on schedule as they can, with the title game coming up on Monday. But College of Idaho has been the number one ranked team nationally. They have all 20 first place votes in that poll, and they are rolling, which I would expect them to do right into the national tournament coming up in about a week and a half.
And I have to say, Troy, a lot of times College of Idaho gets overlooked for basketball because we all focus so much on Boise State, because, you know, it's a bigger conference, bigger college.
Yeah.
But they're a good team, and they've been a good team for quite a few years.
They've had several very good seasons of basketball out there, and this certainly shaping up to be the best chance that they may have at capturing an NAIA national championship. And I do want to note quickly before we go, they're not the only kind of, if you want to categorize them as a small school basketball team. The College of Southern Idaho in Twin Falls is also number one ranked nationally at the junior college level. The women at CSI are ranked number four at the junior college level. Their season finale is Saturday with Salt Lake Community College. The CSI men undefeated this year at 28-0.
I tell you, basketball everywhere. So good luck to all of these teams. And I want to thank all of you for joining us today on Idaho Matters, for taking time out of your busy schedules. So I really do appreciate all of our reporters and all of the work that you put in at your own jobs, and then coming onto our program. So a big thank you to Boise State Public Radio, Troy Oppie. Troy also hosts All Things Considered, so of course, you can hear him later on today right here on Boise State Public Radio News. Ian Stevenson is with the Idaho Statesman. Nate Sunderland is managing editor of EastIdahoNews.com. And Gretchen Parsons is the managing editor with BoiseDev.com. I encourage all of you to take a look at all of their reporting. We've got some really great journalists here in our state. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.